Bienvenidos al podcast del aprendedor, donde encontrarás conversaciones donde aprender y comprender, sobre gente atípica y diferente, con mucho de contar e inspirar. Charlas donde explorar rutinas, hábitos, habilidades, libros y todo aquello que pueda resultar útil para mejorar un cachito de nuestras vidas.
¿Cómo estáis, aprendedores? En el episodio de hoy rompemos un poco esquemas con un episodio en inglés, donde vamos a hablar sobre los tweets de Naval Ravikant. Naval es un tipo único y todo un personaje cuya figura ha trascendido del mundo de los negocios hasta convertirse en una especie de filósofo para los emprendedores y business angels de medio mundo. Sobre Naval conversamos en el podcast con otro indio, Ankur Gupta, amigo y gran profesional, el cual nació en India hace unos cuantos años, lleva en Madrid más de 5, tiene más de 17 años de experiencia en tecnología. Ankur actualmente es director de Europa y Américas de On Mobile, empresa multinacional del mundo de entretenimiento móvil. Ankur ha vivido en más de 10 países y ha lanzado negocios digitales en Europa, Asia y África. Es un especialista en plataformas de entretenimiento digital, marketplaces de e-commerce, etcétera, etcétera. Además de su trabajo en On Mobile, es inversor en startups como Business Angel y además ofrece toda su sabiduría a estas empresas en desarrollo de producto, estrategia de negocio, etcétera, etcétera, etcétera. Naval Ravikant, nacido en Nueva Delhi en 1974, Naval tiene tras él pues una de esas historias que parecen de película. Es un americano. Se trasladó con su familia a Nueva York a los 9 años. Su padre era farmacéutico en la India, pero en este traslado a Estados Unidos no pudo ejercer su profesión y acabó trabajando en una ferretería. Fue una transición difícil para su familia, que acabó con la separación de sus padres. Tanto Naval como su hermano Kamal fueron criados por su madre durante la mayor parte de su infancia, en una época que él, Naval, ha descrito como extremadamente humilde, ¿no? Según el blog hipertextual, hoy Ravikant cuenta con su propio fondo inversor, una fortuna de 60 millones de dólares, y sus tweets han sido recopilados y difundidos por un tercero en un libro que se llama El almanaque de Naval Ravikant, referenciado por el New York Times y en la lista de los más vendidos en Amazon en la sección de emprendimiento. Según cálculos de Wall Street Journal, sus inversiones se traducen en que consigue 0,1 céntimos de dólar por cada viaje en Uber realizado en el mundo. Y con su firma AngelList, su plataforma de inversión, que funciona como una especie de directorio, se han financiado 1.035 empresas con una aportación media de unos 400.000 dólares cada una. Hoy AngelList presume de activos por valor de miles de millones de dólares. Conectando startups con inversores, la plataforma gana dinero exponiendo empresas y quedándose con un porcentaje de su capital a cambio. Pero si por algo se ha hecho conocido Naval Ravikant es por los tweets que durante este tiempo ha ido lanzando en la red social. Venerados por muchos, recopilados por terceros, de él otros quieren extraer recetas para ganar dinero, emprender con éxito y mentalidad. En un lenguaje que parece haber encandilado a muchas personas bajo el paraguas de la historia de éxito rotundo del propio Naval, que no obstante, sus mensajes pueden ser también un caso claro de sesgo de supervivencia. Bueno, no me enrollo más y vamos a la entrevista. Espero que os guste.
Hello, we are here today with with Ankur Gupta, who is a colleague and friend of mine. We are two people that we are followers of Naval Ravikant, and we like a lot the Naval philosophy. So I would like to introduce Ankur. Hello, Ankur. How are you?
Yeah, hi. Thanks, and a pleasure to be here, Cesar.
Good to see that our dreams come true about to make a podcast together.
Fascinating. Yes. It's a good sign. So to close 2022 on a sign that yes, you can make your dreams happen.
Okay.
And it's a very interesting decade. So yeah, I'm looking forward to our conversation today.
Perfect. So we, Ankur, one line on you in order to present to the audience?
Can sure. I am, you know, Ankur Gupta. You know, I usually say I'm born in India, made for the world. Because I think while I was born and raised in India, for the last 20 years I've been traveling around the world, all over Asia, Pacific, Europe, Africa. And yeah, I'm just a curious kid who likes to explore as many things as I can, and from science and technology to business and history, and that's it. So I'm looking forward to how we can use our time together to go a little deeper with Naval's philosophies.
Okay, great. So what I'm gonna do is very quick to introduce Naval, Naval Ravikant. Naval is a prolific tech investor and founder of AngelList. We are gonna probably talk about a lot of things, but he's very famous, his tweet storm, call it how to get rich without getting lucky. We cannot get through most of the tweets in detail because it's a lot, it's impossible, but we will try in the last, in the next minutes to try to speak a little bit about them. I think that, I don't know, where should we start? There is any topic that you would like to start?
No, I'm happy. I mean, whichever you find most interesting, we can pick up one of his tweets or...
Okay, perfect. Okay, there is one of the things that is very, very interesting, and we spoke about it a time ago. It's about value your time at an hourly rate. And he said, and ruthlessly spend to save time at that rate. You will never be worth more than you think you are worth. So...
Yeah, it's a very fascinating idea, and I think we've spoken about it before, but in a sense, I think it's a highly efficient way of decision making. The way I look at it is, at times you will have to make choices between what to do, what not to do, and what to drop and what to pick. And I think one of the frameworks, thumb rules you can create for yourself to prioritize X over Y is to give yourself a price tag. Now, you know, a lot of people say giving yourself a price tag doesn't, it looks a little cheap or a very bit mean, but I think it's just important to have a price tag for your time in your head. And if you know what your price tag, and it could be anything, you know, you could give yourself $10 an hour, or you could give yourself $1,000 an hour. Respect yourself, give your time some price tag, and then it just helps you big things. You know, if you give yourself $100 an hour price tag, you just know what you should do and what you should not do, because you have to keep in mind whatever you will do, is that generating that value for you? Now again, you know, when you start looking at it initially, it may look very abstract. What does it mean? I mean, I'm not getting $100 paid every hour. To begin with, it's a bit abstract, but as you start choosing your battles on a day-to-day basis, things you don't want to do because they don't generate $100 worth of value for you every hour, they start crystallizing in your head. So that's how I look at it.
But if you think so, it's a old thing, because in Spain, for example, it's different. Your salary is per month.
Yes.
Usually.
Yes.
But for example, in England, it should be your salary per week. So you could see, you know, the wager, no? They call the wager, no? Because it's more about
it's a very good point you make there, because I think it's very true that as an Indian, I can vouch more for this philosophy that Naval talks about, because I think in the Western world, especially in the US or in Europe, it's very true that a lot of the compensation, whether it's blue collars or white collars, actually starts with the concept of a weekly hour base, right? So you work for X hours in a week. So you have laws that tell you you have to work 35 hours in a week in France, or 40 hours in a week in Spain, and things like that.
Yeah.
And then you have other scenarios, like, and in US, you almost have wages given to you hourly, right? Whereas in a lot of other economies, especially the emerging markets economies today, while you have that in the blue collar, in the white collar, you probably don't have that. And it's very fascinating, because on the blue collar, you have them at the low price. On the consulting world, you have them on the higher side. But a lot in between, you have a lot of people who are paid salary. And it always works in an approximate hours. You work on a monthly basis, whatever your objectives are, and you don't really measure your output on an hourly basis, right? So you're right, when you look at UK or Europe, you have some sort of a price. But it's important to keep in mind, that's your price being paid by somebody to you. That's your salary. That's not your value.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So that's important. So
one is a price and another thing is a value.
So one is what are you being paid by somebody else?
Yeah.
But then is that what you think your value is?
Yes.
So you might be, it's possible your employer pays you $28 per hour, which translates to this weekly salary or a monthly salary. But is that what your value is? That is up to you. And I think that's where Gwen also says that you will never be more than what you think yourself.
Yeah.
So now let's look at three things here. One is, what's the price that the market is paying for you right now?
Uh-huh.
What's the value that you think your time is worth on an hourly basis? And then, will you ever get more than that? That's highly unlikely. So you want to price yourself in your head, which is your value, as high as you think is realistic and is the best case scenario. And then you always try to work from there to the price that you get in the market. Right. I mean, you may not get that today, you may get that tomorrow. Tomorrow you might be able to create more value, and which is where we'll have a chance to talk about upskilling yourself, you know, always creating more leverage through skill, which would basically create more value. Because today, in 2022, you might be a 25-year-old who prices, you know, kind of values his hour at $100.
Mm-hmm.
10 years from now, you don't want to be creating the same value worth $100 per hour, you want to be creating $500 or maybe $1,000 value. How will you get there? So that's your skill, experience, which creates that leverage for you. And that's what you want to grow. So today you want to have a value. You want to see the price in the market. You want to minimize the gap between the price that market pays for you versus the value you think. And you also want to keep working on improving that value over a bit long period of time.
It comes from the five big things. No, he said that the professional should have specific knowledge, he said. No. He said leverage.
Mm-hmm.
And what it was, the other one, leverage, judgment,
mm-hmm.
no? Personal learning process, no? Something mm-hmm. like that, he said. And I don't remember the first. I think it was leverage, specific knowledge. I don't remember the other one. Anyway.
Okay.
Speaking about all the five that will come to my mind in a while, what do you think what is the most important? Because you speak about the value and the price, what do you think is more important in order to know the value? What is the value? How do you know what is exactly the hourly rate that you?
So, good question. I think.
Not only because of your salary.
I don't think, because, yes, and I think that's a very good point to keep in mind. It's obvious if you're someone new to this idea, and if you're somebody thinking about this concept for the first time,
mm-hmm.
you're most likely going to look at your value as the current earnings that you have.
Yeah.
Because that's your anchor, right?
Yeah.
So you have an anchor, you have an X salary per month, or you're a consultant who is being offered, you know, who's offering certain services to clients at an hourly rate. So that's the currently labeled price for your time. So you have a very clear anchor, and there's a high possibility you will start there as your value. But that's where it is important. Now, on the other hand, you want to have a value in your head. So when you start early enough, very, very early, that's possible. It's possible that what would happen is you would get it wrong, right?
Yeah.
I mean, because you have no idea where to start.
Yeah.
So the where to start is obviously tricky, and how you would basically want to see what is your aspiration.
Yeah.
You know, again, when you look at Naval's idea, it's a lot around, wealth creation. If wealth creation is your idea, you have certain idea and aspiration of what wealth you want to create. If that is the kind of what wealth you want to create, you want to hinge onto that as a long-term plan of 5, 10, 15, 20, 25 years.
Okay.
And then see how do you get there. And you want to create that value, right? Not what you're earning today or what you're being, what your price tag is, but what is it that you want to achieve, and that's your value.
Yeah.
That's your value. And you start there. And then you start working with it quickly to optimize your decisions, to choose where to apply your time, ruthlessly not do things that don't align with that price tag, your value tag, and then make sure that you find the equilibrium. There's a high likelihood that you have either, you know, assumed too high or you have assumed too low. There's no such thing as too high because, again, you can keep improving. But if you consciously and meticulously look at it and keep an eye on it in virtually in your head over a short period of time, you know, I mean, I think over a short period of time, you would be able to realize whether you are not looking at it correctly and you would be able to optimize and find an equilibrium for it. But yes, to begin with, you will have to give it a hypothetical value, which has to be carefully looked at, not relating it to your current price tag at which you're selling your time. And it's different, right? One is how much do you value your time? And second is at what price are you selling it?
Yeah, that's it. But that is completely different, probably.
Exactly, that would be very different.
But you have to put something in between, no? In order to, if somebody asks you, I have to hire you for that work, mm-hmm. you should know your hourly rate.
Exactly. So that's one, again, and that's what I'm saying, that you can have a price tag mm-hmm. at which you're selling it.
Yeah.
So you need to know that.
Yeah.
You're selling it at that rate because that's what the market is willing to pay you that.
Okay.
Which might be different from what you think actually you could or you would want to sell it.
Yeah.
Because you value your time differently. So if I could sell it at $1,000 per hour, I would like to. However, right now the market seems to be offering me only $250. And that's how it works even with all products, right? Some products have a very high cost, but then they are sold on losses because the market doesn't offer them the same price.
Yeah.
Some products make a lot more profits because while the cost is very low, the market is willing to offer a very high price.
Yeah.
So that's how, I mean, and eventually in the long runs, those arbitrage around cost versus actual price narrows down over a longer period of time, and that's what you do with your own time. So you value your time at an hour, at a rate, and then you make sure that you sell it as well as you can, as close to the price that you value. But when you define that value in your head, you have to detach yourself by not anchoring yourself at the current price that you have in mind, that you know that that's what the market
is paying. At the end, if you think that is 100, you should take 200, no? I mean, let's put it that way, the double, no?
Not necessary. It depends a lot on your awareness of the fact that it is possible that if market is paying 100 for you today, you understand that's what you deserve. And you would like to have 200, but for which you need to do more, you need to create more value, which is why it becomes important to understand how do you create value, what value are you creating, understanding the impact you're making in somebody else's requirements. Eventually, if you can solve the world's problems, to which there are people who are willing to pay for that, you can create more value and you can charge for that value. That's how you make wealth, right? I mean, if you can pick a problem which people are willing to pay for, you can make money out of it. So yes, if today you're being paid as a price $100, it doesn't mean you should ask for 200. Why not 500? Or why not try to make 100 as soon as you can, because maybe by tomorrow somebody's not going to give you even 100. It might go down to 90. So it's important. I think the sense of awareness about your own value creation is very important. And that allows you to find the right equilibrium.
Coming to another topic that he said, he said, what is the most important thing to do for younger people starting out? He asked. And he said, spend more time making the big decisions. And he said, very interesting thing, that there are basically three really big decisions you make in your early life. I don't know if in your early life, you can do it in your 40s or your 50s, but anyway, where you live, who you are with, and what you do. We spend very little time deciding which relationships to get into, because at the end, you know, your relationship is with the people that you know in your work, in your friends, on your family, and these kind of things. No, we spend so much time in a job, but we spend so little time deciding which job to get into. Choosing what city to live in can almost completely determine the trajectory of your life. If you are in India, or you are in Spain, or you are in US, your life is completely different. Mm-hmm. So, what do you think about this?
Very interesting. I mean, before we actually pick into what do I think about those three things, you also mentioned, it's not necessary you have to make those decisions when you're only young. You could make them in your 40s and 50s. And I think I would rather start there, because that's the whole idea of leverage, and time is your biggest lever. Because yes, it's not a question of why should young people only think about those three things. You could think about those three things in 40s or 50s, but the impact of making the right decision on one of these three or all three of them in 50s is going to be much less if you make those decisions in 20s. So it's not a question of can you not make those choices in 50s. Yes, you can. But then the impact it will have on you the rest of your life is going to be much lesser, because time is what your leverage is. If you make those decisions in 20s and they work well, you might make exactly same decision and work well in 50s, but at 70 the outcome will be radically different, which is why time is your leverage, and which is why you want to make those decisions as early as possible. Now let's look at those three things that he's talking about. You know, what do you do, where do you live, and who do you work with, right? Now I think one thing that I kind of slightly disagree with the idea is it's also a, I also believe it's a privileged choice the privilege to actually be able to make that choice is a great privilege. So I think in this world there are many people who don't have the privilege to choose where they want to work, or to choose what they want to do, or to choose with whom they want to work. So if you do have that privilege, then yes, I think those are the three things that matter the most. Because when you look at what do you do in your early years, or when you start working for yourself, or and today I think the age of working is even coming down with internet. I think Naval is a big, you know, he promotes the whole idea of how internet has changed the way the land of opportunities work. With internet, everybody has an opportunity everywhere. And I think that's one reason why I think in these three factors, the impact of location has come down. Because it is, especially after COVID, I think location has become slightly less important, but not in the context that where do you work from or what do you do, but it's about what's the access to the opportunity. Where do you live is about how much access to the opportunity do you have. And I was just talking to a friend 2 days ago. We talked about it does make a lot of difference if you're born, when you're born, if you're born somewhere in let's say Latin America, in Guatemala, or if you're born somewhere in Madrid, right? I mean, your access to opportunity changes. So where do you, where are you born? However, fortunately, you don't choose. That happens to you. So the second time you have that opportunity is when you start working. Where can you be reborn? So that's when you, this time you have a choice, where do you want to start again? And in your, probably, let's assume for a moment, if you start working at, in early 20s, where do you choose that? Because that is where your opportunity set will come in. What opportunities do you have is driven by where, that location. Similarly, when you look at the other two things, who do you work with? Like, I mean, you and me also enjoy a lot about Tim Ferriss, and we always believe Tim Ferriss is the one who's famous for having said that you're the average of the five people that you spend the most time with. So who do you work with essentially is what you're going to be average. Who are the people you spend most of your time? And when you talk about work, if you look at a third of our life, you know, is all about work. So, or more sometimes. So who are the people you work with? Do you share that passion and energy with working, for working with them? That matters. So, and then the third element was the location, the people you work with, and what do you work for? I mean, I, again, I think as a, the life is, we have is short. I mean, even if you live a fairly long life of 80, 90 years, it's a pretty short life. When you look at Earth, you know, when you look at the world, and our lives of 100 years are really short in the context that the world has been here for millions of years and will probably be here for a very, very long time, good or bad, whichever way it will be, right? But we are here only for 100 years, so it's a short life. What do you work on? I think it's a sad thing if people get to work, you know, you don't work on that what you enjoy. So, and if you are able to, you know, kind of pour your skills, passion, and energy into what you enjoy, I mean, that just changes the trajectory of the outcomes, right? So it goes back to what do you work on matters, because that's where you put your energies and passion into. Where do you, where do you work drives the opportunities that you will have access to. And who do you work with will essentially keep you, you know, keep feeding you back with new ideas, new energy, and new opportunities and new learning. So essentially, I think they again become three levers on time. So I would rather look at them as time is the underlying lever, and then you apply more levers on each one of them to compound. And these are the three important things that I can tell you.
Because I will put that in a new thing that we can speak about it, about Naval. He said about making money should be a function of your identity and what you like to do. Mm-hmm. And he said in another tweet that find three hobbies, one that makes you money, one that keeps you fit, and what that makes you creative. Mm-hmm. He said that he will change that, no, slightly. He said one that makes you money, one that makes you fit, and one that you makes smarter. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, we are speaking about that three questions and find three hobbies. No, we are speaking about three things. No, and in this point, find three hobbies, one that makes you money. This is the same as you mentioned before. If you have the privilege to choose, then you can find something, but at the end makes a lot of sense, because if you're a bartender, for example, I mean, I know that there's a lot of people is bartender because they don't have other job, or they cannot find, or whatever, no, the things are very difficult to find, no. If you're a journalist, it's very difficult to work in the, you know, in the newspaper, no, for example, no. So you have to work, as an example, I put that example, no. And what do you think that these three hobbies could change your life or not?
Of course, I think we also know Naval is always very vocal about prioritizing health. So yeah. Finding a hobby that yeah. keeps you healthy, I think, is the natural progression in which he would look at things. I think calling it have three hobbies is obviously a nice way of putting it, so that you can it can stick around. You know, it's yeah. obviously a very good tweet, a very good thing to write as a tweet. I think it will gain enough attraction. But overall, yes, finding those three hobbies is about having. I mean, I think finding those three hobbies is kind of making it simpler to call having living a purposeful life.
Yeah. Right?
I mean, if you could have those clear purposes for which you live, right? I mean, because hobbies is something that you are happy to spend time on.
Yeah.
And if you're happy to spend time on keeping your good health, uh-huh. or you know, working on things that help you make money, or you know, make you creative, then you are going to live a purposeful life. Mm-hmm. And going back to the earlier point you mentioned about making money is a function of, yes, I think that's important, because I guess making money by itself is a derivative of the other things and the bigger purpose that you find, right? I mean, yes, you would want to make a lot of wealth, but then that wealth eventually has to serve you a good life. So you would want to do things which you enjoy, which serve the purpose that you have in mind, but that also generates wealth for you, right? That is how I would look at it.
Okay. I was thinking about the next point, and he said that in one tweet, they said, your goal in life is to find the people, business, project, or art that needs you the most, no? There is something out there just for you. What you don't want to do, I mean, what you don't want to do is build checklists and decision frameworks built on what other people are doing. You are never going to be them. You will never be good at being somebody else. So you have to be you. And in that sense, I think that what do you think is the goal? I mean, what is the perspective that Navar have about the goal of our life? What do you think about it?
Yeah, I think we can also look at that from the Japanese idea of ikigai.
Ikigai, right? Okay.
Yeah, I think eventually, yes, you could do what other people are doing, but you would probably not enjoy it for long enough. And you could do and have you can live your life through what others expected out of you, but you would probably never come out happy enough and be at your best if you don't do what you were meant for or what you wanted to do. But at the same time, I also think it's not easy. It's not easy for everyone to find that calling.
I think it's
about being open. I would look at it that it's about being open-minded to make sure that you're aware that you know what you might be looking for. If you can find that, great. If you cannot, you keep working towards finding that.
Yeah.
So, which is where I link it back to Ikigai, because there is something that is meant for you. There is something that only you can do. if you can find that opportunity, which is designed, which is the best for you, mm-hmm. because you are the best for it, then that's something, yes, that's something that you should choose, come what may. But also, it's not going to happen for most people so easily. So it's also something we need to keep. It's not that you start looking for your calling, you know, over the weekend and start thinking what is it that you can do. But yes, that it's important to keep in mind. And that is what you eventually want to get to.
Yeah. Other tweet that is very interesting is about, he said, when you are young, you have time and you have health, but you have no money. When you are in the middle age, you have money and you have health, but you have no time. And when you are old, you have money and you have time, but you have no health. So he said the trifecta, it means, you know, the three yeah. things, is trying to get all three at once.
And by the way, I like the trifecta. I like the point of trifecta because I call them simple triangles. You know, like
triangles. Okay. Probably is better.
Because I think most principles in life have triangles. And by the way, you know, geometrically, a triangle is considered as one of these most strongest, figures.
Okay. So in the nature, no?
In the nature, yes. Okay. Yes. In the universe, triangle geometrically seems to have one of the strongest mm-hmm. power bases, I mean, in terms of equilibrium. Mm-hmm. So I think it's fascinating that most things have this trade-off between three things, you know, and like Namal is saying here, the trifecta is of health, time, and wealth, right? Let's call money. You can either be born with them, mm-hmm. right? If you're born into a royal family, you're probably going to have time because you're young, and then you have health because you're young and you have money. So if you're not born with that, it's highly unlikely that you have all three at the beginning.
Yeah.
So the goal has to be, like you said, the goal has to be to minimize the gap and see how soon can you get to have all the three. Because what you don't want to do is to compromise on your health to get the money too quickly, nor to keep your health and get the money when you're too old. So eventually you need to find the ways to make sure, and which is where it comes back to leverage, and which is why you need to start making important decisions as soon as possible in your life, because the sooner you make the right decisions in your younger life, the compounding allows you to have money soon enough. Now, you could take 15 to 20 years to figure out life at the age of 40 and then start making important decisions, which means you might, and usually, I mean, it's my way of looking at things. I think a lot of the compounding kind of starts showing results only 10, 20 years down the line. And that's how it works, right? So if you make early decisions, the right ones, thinking about the important things in your early 20s, there's a high likelihood that you might see great returns and results by 40s. And 40s is still young, right? So you get to have the three without compromising your health. Now, again, that's why it's the trifecta. You could say you could work very hard and, you know, have a burnout by the end of 30 when you have lots of money, but you don't have health. So while keeping your health, what can you do to apply the highest leverage? And decisions are your highest leverage, right? And decisions on time are your highest leverage, which is why you need to work towards getting the money at the earliest without compromising your health.
But the problem, I think, that is not to make the right decisions. The problem is to maintain the right decisions in time, you know? Because you can make a right decision when you are 25, but suddenly in your 30s, you do something that is probably a good decision, but the outcome is very bad. I mean, the compounding interest is absolutely one of the most interesting things that Naval speaks about it, and I would like to speak about it later. But sometimes you make a very good decision, you are 25, but the problem is that after 5 years you can change that decision to another one. So that good decision is changing.
Yeah, eventually, it's a long game, right? I mean, you could undo, I mean, the only thing is, of course, you could undo the goods, right? I mean, you could make right decisions in 20s and then go on to, make some foolish decisions in 30s. That undo all the good work that you have done. So yes, I mean, there is no alternative. I mean, making good decisions does not allow you to make bigger wrong decisions. I mean, yes, making good decisions early on allows you to make actually gives you more room for making smaller, stupid decisions in 30s. If you make good, big, strong decisions in 20s, it still gives you room to make smaller, wrong decisions in 30s. But if you've not made any good decision in 20s, it probably gives you no room to make bad decisions in 30s. So it still gives you leverage, right? Of course, making good decisions in 30s and making bigger bad decisions in 30s is not going to work. But yes, you still have to maintain your decisions and your choices over your long game.
Yeah.
Yes, you could go, and it's the same in the long run, right? I mean, you could do very well for 40 years and then you suddenly go and bet your house at 65 in a casino and lose everything overnight and go bankrupt. Yeah, that could happen. So that's why
you have to keep thinking. This is the Kelly criterion, no? He speaks about Kelly criterion, that you don't have to bet all in one.
Absolutely. I mean, betting everything on one decision and you know, who knows what kind of decision that is, how much control you have on that, etc. I mean, that's not very smart. So if you're doing something not so very smart and you're betting everything at 65, having done very good for 35 years,
that's not
smart. So,
yeah.
I mean, just making good decisions does not allow you to make bigger bad decisions.
Yeah.
So yes, you have to, you said, you know, you have to maintain your decisions. Yes, of course you have to maintain them.
But you think that the time only changes. I mean, if something we know for sure is that we have to pay. There are two things that we know. We will gonna be dead, no?
Mm-hmm.
Dead, no?
You're gonna die one day, yes.
One day, no? And the other one is we're gonna pay in taxes, no? So
mm-hmm.
This is the two things that we know for sure we will do, no? So it will happen. And, you know, things change a lot. I mean, you can take the decisions, but, I mean, the point with the compound interest, that is an amazing concept, and, I mean, probably is one of the most interesting concepts in our world, no?
Yeah.
By the way, you have the graphic in my our company in Under to Understand, but the point is to maintain that in the time. That is, for me, the big thing, no? But, yeah.
Yeah, so again, absolutely. I mean, and to keep at it, I mean, I think compound interest is a good example of, it's not only that things compound magically and start growing exponentially at a later stage, but they do that only if you keep at it, right? So if you look at an investment, if you're investing X every month, which will start suddenly giving you a lot more returns in the 10th year onwards, because now it's starting to grow exponentially, only if you don't start withdrawing the cash. If you start breaking the being at it, if you don't stick at it,
mm-hmm.
then you will not see the magic of compounding. So if you want to see the magic of compounding, you have to stay with it for the long run,
but to stay in the long run, it requires that you love what you are doing, that you are enjoying the things that you are doing without any output or any economical effect. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I'm thinking about it. In order to have compound, you need to do things that you really love. No, it's like playing soccer, no? For example,
I would say probably not. I mean, I would actually say it's not necessary that you have to really love them, but probably you have to understand them.
Yeah.
Like, I think and of course, if you love them, you would be happier because you would enjoy them more. But if you're doing the right thing, and probably if you don't have natural love towards it, you're going to enjoy it less. But this includes something like something as simple as investing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Most investing would give you returns only in the long run.
Yeah.
But then if you're somebody who is not enjoying it initially, or does not enjoy the fact that you're paying out investing, not able to save the money,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, that's fine. You don't enjoy it, you don't like it. But you would be able to stick around if you understand why you're doing this.
Yeah.
If you have clear ideas of the goals that you want to accomplish in 25 years, then you would be able to stick around and see those exponential results.
He said, Naval, in another tweet, it's related to what you are saying now. He said, play iterated games. All the returns in life, whether in wealth, relationships, or knowledge, come from compound interest.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, big business partners with high intelligence, energy, and above all, integrity. This is big thing. Big deal. I mean, to find people like that is not easy. So my question here is that, do you think that in that iterated games, do you think that is the compound interest? I mean, how do you link compound interest with iterated games?
Oh, okay, interesting. I think the way you would link compound interest for iterated game, because most games are not one-off games, right? So the idea of iterated games is that, look, most transactions we do are not something that if I have done this transaction, especially in work, mm-hmm. that if I do this one transaction and then it's over and then we'll never see each other. And most of those transactions, by the way, are not very worthy, mm-hmm. because if you're kind of getting into a transaction that's only one time, it's highly likely that everybody on that transaction is trying to make the most for themselves and not for the other party, which means it's probably going to be a highly inefficient transaction. Mm-hmm. Which is why if you don't want to play that inefficient transaction game, you want to play the efficient transaction game, in which you actually want to do multiple rounds of play. And when you play those multiple rounds of play, which is essentially iterated game, both parties understand that you're here. Which allows you, which gives you the opportunity to play it with more integrity. Mm-hmm. And the higher the integrity, the better the payoffs in that game for both sides are. So eventually if you play iterated games, you give both parties or multiple players, give each other multiple chances, because you're playing the long game with multiplayer, multi-move scenario, it gives you the room to actually apply levers every time, and that is why in the long run it'll lead to compounding. If you play only one time game, like if I give you this, give me that, there's no room for compounding. Because it's a one time transaction. But if you play multi-time transaction, it gives you the room to apply value and create returns on every move. If you have many moves, you will have returns on every move, and eventually in the long run, the moves that will come much later will start giving you returns that are compounded. So multiplayer iterated, multiplayer or multi-iteration games give you the opportunity to apply compounding, and then it takes a long time. So that's how I guess, you know, iterated games come together with the long duration, which applies the leverage of time, and then it leads to compounding.
Okay. And he said another tweet that pick an industry where you can play long-term games with long-term people, and you will get rich by giving society what it wants, but does not yet know how to get it at the scale. What do you think about it?
Yeah, I think I probably don't get everything in that, but I guess giving a society what it wants at scale is very much, you know, I think probably used quite exhaustively in the startup world, in the entrepreneurship scenarios. You always look at it saying you have to pick a problem for which there are users. Which is why, you know, I mean, in this startup world, they talk about how big is this problem, because you want to have, you can pick problems where people would pay you for that problem, but there are probably not enough of them, which means there are not enough users, which is why the point of scale comes in. So you want to pick a problem for which the world needs a solution and is willing to pay you, and you want to solve that problem at scale if there are many users around the world who are willing, who face the same problem. So if you can do that, then that creates the opportunity you want to have to work on.
Dice, specific knowledge is knowledge that you cannot be trained for. If society can train you, it can train someone else and replace you. So when a specific knowledge is taught, it's through apprenticeship, not schools. A specific knowledge is often highly technical or creative. It cannot be outsourced or automated. What do you think about it?
Yeah, I think there. I would look at it from two lenses, right? One is about what can you be trained on, what can you learn? Nonetheless, I mean, I always believe that I think learning is less about teaching and more about learning. And what I mean by that is you cannot teach somebody they don't want to learn, but you can learn somehow even if somebody doesn't want to teach you. So it's the void that you have if you are willing to learn something. Now, what can you learn and what can you be trained on? And that's why I think what he's saying is if someone can be trained, then anyone can be trained, which means that's the skills that can be imparted to someone, and it need not be you. But what you can learn is what you want to learn, and that's your unique sweet spot. So if you can find what your unique sweet spot is, and you can learn that.
What is sweet spot?
Sorry. So sweet spot is like an intersection of, it's an intersection of a few different things. Like, how would I call a sweet spot? A sweet spot is an intersection of the best of multiple things, right? Mm-hmm. So
the best of multiple things.
Yes.
Okay.
So for example, a sweet spot for us could be, let's say in a business sense, a market, we do payments in giving. So a country which is seeing a lot of traction for new giving services, but does not have enough good payment gateways because the credit card penetration is low.
Okay.
So a telco billing for payments, that country would be a great sweet spot to offer telco billing for gaming services.
Okay.
Right. That would be your. I mean, as a product company, a service provider, that becomes your sweet spot because this is the place you want to operate your business, right?
Yeah.
So a sweet spot is anything that's basically at the intersection of multiple things, the best of good things of many things, kind of scenario. But my point was that it's a sweet spot that you want to find for yourself. What is it that you enjoy learning? What is it that you can be trained on that others cannot be trained on? Because it's your desire to learn and do that and build or bring a skill in yourself that others don't need or don't want. So that's your sweet spot. And then you apply leverage on that because nobody else can be trained on that because that becomes your special skill.
Yeah, one of the things that it's called el aprendedor is mm-hmm. because of that.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are, from my point of view, my humble point of view, there are two kinds of people: people that they want to learn, and people that they don't want to.
Yeah.
And it's not only to teach. I mean, because Richard Feynman said that if you want to learn something, teach it. No.
Mm-hmm.
So what I mean is that that two kinds of people that I think is. You can differentiate all over the world. That two things, that two profiles, makes the difference between guys who want to. I mean, but sometimes to learn is not easy, and you need references. No, he said apprenticeships. I think if you have, for example, apprenticeship of Warren Buffett or whatever, this is not. I mean, this is something that is impossible. It's not happening, no? I mean, mm-hmm. you can apprenticeship if you aren't reading his books on these things, but you are learning things, but it's not apprenticeship. It's you are learning, that's it, no?
Yeah.
So, in another point is that he said that if you can code,
mm-hmm.
no, write books and blogs, record videos and podcasts. This is something that we are doing now, no?
Yeah.
So, what do you think about it?
No, I think that is something I personally... follow and think makes a lot of sense to me. Yeah. I think, and to be honest, like coding is definitely if you cannot code, because I think coding is a bit of magic, right? Because when you can code, you enjoy the fact that whatever anybody's idea is, you can actually code and create that. So it's almost very close to magic.
Yeah.
But if you cannot code, the reason, he talks about you should write or write a book or record a podcast or do a video is because I think creation is very important, right? So this is the creativity. So
yeah.
I mean, yes, not every coder may have a lot of creativity, but it requires creativity to code well, to create products, and create anything. But at the same time, you need to be creative to do any podcast recording or to do any video recording or just write anything. So that's actually something that comes out of your brain, and especially if you write, and it's not about writing emails at work because you're doing that as a transaction because somebody else is invoking that transaction into you. But when you do your own recording or writing, you're basically forcing yourself to think, which is essentially your creation. And that's why, it all ties back to his ideas of, developing hobbies that make you creative. You want to create things. The best way to create is to write a code and create something out of it. If you can't do that, it's important to be creating in other forms. I mean, there are many forms of content. I mean, you can call it creating content or creating information or creating ideas. And how do you make those ideas more tangible? You have to start somewhere. So the first thing is do a podcast or write it down. when you write it down, you can eventually go on to write code for it to actually create that. But that's just a very, very important way of expressing your creativity in a tangible form.
And other thing that it's interesting is about, he said about judgment. Judgment requires experience, but can be built faster by learning foundational skills. And you know that—
From what skills?
Yes. Then there is no skill called business.
Yeah.
He said avoid business magazines and business classes. Study macroeconomics, game theory, psychology, persuasion, ethics, mathematics, and computers. So you did an MBA in SEAD, no? Me, that I did an MBA in a business school. Probably, you know, if I knew that before, I will not go to do a master, no?
So like, interesting. I mean, if you say that you wouldn't have done it if you knew that before, that's interesting, because I've been following Naval for a long time, before I did my late stage, you know, very late in my late 30s when I did my exec MBA. But I think I would, and to complete that point, I will also say that I don't think I will say don't read a business magazine or don't do an MBA. I think, however, the underlying factor is true, right? There's nothing called as business skill. I mean, it's not a business as a skill.
Yes.
I think business is a combination of many different skills. Mm-hmm. What is business in the first place? It's a life move, right? You operate in life, you do trade, and that requires lots of things. So you should study, yes, you should study game theory, mathematics, computers, and everything. Those are elementary skills. Those are elementary skills. If you're strong on the elementary skills, you can put them together to do more. Now, I think, how do you put them together to do more? Eventually, you have to operate in the world and work with other people. I think an MBA, for example, is just an opportunity for you to work with other people.
Yes, absolutely. This is the big thing.
Yeah. So, absolutely. I think to a large extent, the MBA, and in the MBA, they try to teach you a lot of these things, game theory and mathematics and whatnot. But I think the idea is to bring in a lot of the individual skills together to be able to do a full-blown operations, right? So how do you do that? How do you do business? I mean, can a mathematician do good business? Not necessarily, right? So a mathematician may not be a good businessman. A good game theory professor may not be a good businessman.
Absolutely.
So each of these skills is very important to do good business, but then you have to bring a lot of these skills together to do good business, and that is something you can learn, develop when you get to work with the right people. One of the places to find a lot of interesting people like yourself is an MBA. So that's why it's all about networking, and that's why it's all about finding the right people to work with. The other thing that it talks about is that, you know, you should do these skills, and I think there was something you mentioned before at the beginning of this one that...
But you mean what? What do you mean? Sorry. Study macroeconomics, games theory, psychology, persuasion, ethics,
avoid
mathematics and computers.
I was just saying that essentially what it means is, right, there's no such thing as business skill. Business skill is a combination of lots of elementary skills. So the more of those elementary skills you know, the better you will be. Now the other thing that he said that judgment is basically about experience. And I think yes. So the question is, judgment will develop with experience, right? There is a sense of judgment. You will see some people have a better sense of judgment. That's more like talent versus, you know, competency. Some people will just have a better sense-making capability of connecting the dots in the world to sense things faster than some other people. But then it will not grow or become bigger or better if you don't grow in terms of experience. So experience is what is going to help you develop your judgment. The question is, how do you get more experience? And the problem with most people, like again, like those famous quotes, it's not the number of years of experience you have. It's the experience you have every year. So which is why it boils down to what are you, how many things are you doing? What are you doing? How many of them are actually helping you learn something new? If you're doing lots of things that don't help you learn something new, your experience is not going to help you improve your judgment. So in a sense, it boils down to your judgment is a derivative of your experience, and the experience that is helping you learn something new. So, and you can fast track that improved sense of judgment development if you try to learn many different things faster in a smaller time, smaller amount of time.
I think that other thing is about that you are mentioning now, that judgment. He said that judgment requires experience, but can be built faster by learning foundational skills. And he said that avoid business magazines and these kind of things. And he said, read the grades in math, in science, and philosophy. And he said, ignore your contemporaries and news. Avoid tribal identification. Put truth above social approval. What do you think about it? I think it's, I mean, it's, I completely agree, because at the end, the noise of the what is coming currently in the world, I mean, you cannot see, you know, the good, you cannot see the, how to say, the forest, no?
Yeah.
You only see the tree.
Don't lose the woods or the forest, right?
Yeah. So I think that, I mean, rate the grades in math, science, and philosophy is amazing, but it's hard, it's not easy. So, but in any case, it's a kind of, no, if you can do that, probably you will be out of the what's going on in life, no? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, at the end of the day, I think there will always be a lot of noise around you. And more so in today's time with the mainstream media,
yeah.
I think this is always too much of noise. So, which again goes back to how do you apply leverage in your time? Because you need to minimize the noise and increase the signals. How do you minimize noise? By avoiding, you know, mainstream news, and lots of other non-foundational skills. What you eventually need to build is foundational skills, and then have the, then build skills to use those foundational skills together to create more value. Yeah. And then you apply that on time to apply leverage. The sooner you do it, the more time you have and more compounding you will eventually have.
Okay, changing the topic of Naval and trying to wrap up of this conversation, he said, other tweet that is a calm mind, a fit body, and a house of full of love. These things cannot be bought; they must be earned.
Hmm.
I think it's
I think this is more like the gospel. No, this is a little bit like gospel, and it's like the most elementary truth for living a happy life.
Right? But I mean, sometimes we forget these kind of things. But this is other thing that he said is happiness, love, and passion aren't things you find. There are choices you make. This is make absolutely.
Yeah. And one of my very good friends always used to say this, you know, many years ago, happiness is not a choice, it's a state of mind. Because basically you have to choose to be happy. And if you want to choose that, then you basically go in that direction. And again, like you said, you know, calm mind, fit body, house full of love. These are things you cannot buy. I mean, there is, because this is at the most foundational level, this is what everybody is looking for.
Yeah.
If they could be bought, then everybody would have bought them. And that's it. I mean, life's pursuit, and you know, we would not have any more pursuits left. Right. So eventually that is the most phenomenally, you know, fundamental thing that we all need to have in our lives. We more often than not forget it. But then, we need to keep at it and stick around with it.
Yeah. And a good, what kind of, I mean, you know that in the Almanac of Naval Ravikant, at the end of the book, he speaks about a list of books, no?
Mm-hmm.
What would you recommend to the audience? What do you think for you are the best book on all this list?
Wow, that's a good question. I don't think I would probably have a recommendation of book myself, but I guess, I mean, like Naval Ravikant himself says, you know, he picks up two books usually for everyone, saying if there's only one or two book somebody wants to pick from his list, he has to Fabric of Reality.
Okay.
And I think they're by the same author, David Deutsch.
Okay.
And there's another one by him. I've read The Fabric of Reality. It's a difficult book because it's very elementary and fundamental around science and connecting everything around it. So I would say, yeah, one can pick up one of those books.
And the Stoicism, no? He speaks about...
Stoicism. But I think
Seneca,
also...
Marco Aurelio.
Yeah, Stoicism is a philosophy I mean, it's a philosophy that you have to start appreciating and then probably go into picking a book to read it. I mean, I think it's very easy to Google around and see what Stoicism means. And, you know, like, would you want to kind of live that kind of life? Where your idea is to, you know, like, you're here, so it's okay to kind of accept pain and, you know, live with it because it's part of life. But yeah, I mean, if it's something that you enjoy, then eventually you can pick some of the books. But I think it's important to get familiar with the ideas first.
In order to wrap up, I would say another tweet of Naval, no? That if you want to comment, you're very welcome. And he said, value your time. It's all you have. It's more important than your money, it's more important than your friends, it's more important than anything. Your time is all you have, don't waste your time. Probably is the...
I think it's a very good closure.
A very good closure and comes to the beginning, because at the end all is a circle. Absolutely. So come from the beginning about the wage rate and what is your value per hour. At the end, this is...
So I'm very glad we spent this time, you know, over the last 1 hour or so, we spent time talking about all his philosophies. And I think, yes, so I'm glad that we didn't waste the time we've chosen it, this 1 hour to speak about all these ideas. And absolutely, I mean, time is all we have. And it's the one that bends all the realities, right? What is time? When it start? When will it finish? We don't know. So time is all we have.
So, So we need to enjoy. So, man, we should cheers with our wine here. And thank you for your time. Thank you for the conversation.
And thank you for the opportunity. And it was great talking to you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Take care.
Recuerda que puedes suscribirte en elaprendedor.com para no perderte ningún capítulo. Te espero en el próximo episodio con la próxima charla. Gracias y hasta la próxima.